Jason Solomons here. Welcome back to Film Weekly. Oh yes, after the soul genius of Billy Paul on last week's show, this week, the soul and the funk once again return to the silver screen with the release of a superb new documentary, Soul Power. The long-forgotten story of the music festival that took place alongside the Rumble in the Jungle, the Foreman versus Ali fighting Zaire, 1974. James Brown, The Spinners, Bill Withers, Celia Cruz, just some of the performers at this extravaganza, and we meet the man who, alongside Hugh Masekela, made it happen, Stuart Levine, legendary music producer, right here on Film Weekly. Also on this week's show, we return to our Robin Wright Penn and Rebecca Miller interview as they talk about The Private Lives of Pippa Lee, released this week. And Zan Brooks is back. This week we'll be reviewing the Paul Schrader classic Mishima alongside Claire Denis' film 35 Shots of Rum. Oh, and that little film about the campus Austrian fashion reporter ever. Ah, what is his name? Let me think. Oh yeah, Bruno, you know it. Will the hype match the hilarity? Find out later on Film Weekly.
Somebody asked me, what are you going to bring back? You're going to bring back any souvenirs? Somebody wants cloth and all like that. What I want to bring back is the feeling.
I think of us as a people that were maybe left out in the desert. We were taken away and dropped off in the desert by parachute. We know that we got a home someplace, but where?
That is the wonderful Bill Withers and B.B. King there in a scene from what has to be Film Weekly's pick of the week, if not the year, the documentary Soul Power. Most people have seen or remember the documentary about the Rumble in the Jungle, When We Were Kings. It won an Oscar. It told the story of the George Foreman versus Muhammad Ali fight, took place in Kinshasa in 1974. But what was forgotten was that alongside that fight, documented by Leon Gast in When We Were Kings, there was a small clip of a music festival that took place alongside it. Stuart Levine and Hugh Masekela put together a dream ticket of US and African performers for a three-day music festival. Now, the festival went ahead as scheduled. The fight was postponed because George Foreman cut his eye, but they went ahead with the festival anyway. So it never really made it to the screen. Lucky for us, they also shot hundreds of hours of film of the preparation of the concert and of the concert itself. And more than three decades later, Jeffrey Levy-Hint, who edited When We Were Kings, went back into the vault and got this stuff out and directed this new film, Soul Power. He's piecing together an extraordinary account of that musical exchange. The film features a stupendous performance from James Brown, top of the bill, a star turn. When I spoke to legendary music producer Stuart Levine, I started out by asking him how the idea for a festival in Kinshasa even came about.
The night that I came up with the idea of doing this, I had gone to some kind of sporting event. I think it was a basketball game, and I was reading the newspaper. I was bored with where I was, and there was an announcement of the fight between Ali and Foreman. And you know, beside being a musician and a music record producer, I was also a big fight fan from the time I was a boy. You know. And so it interested me right away, and it said it was taking place in Zaire. The irony is that I had just left finishing a Crusaders album, so I was very active. I had a label, and we were making records, and everything was fine. And I read this article, and a light went off in my head, which was, I said, wow, almost like it was a joke. I said, we should put a music festival around this. And I was sitting next to Masekela at the sporting event, and we could have 3 days of music and fighting, you know. The idea came out of a desire to create more consciousness for African artists and musicians, and to bring up the level of acknowledging the great, you know, African American. At that time, we weren't calling them African American.
Yeah.
Black artists, I still prefer to call them that, and that were there, and it just kind of made sense.
Because it's great to have a festival, and I think, it seems very laudable, and you want to put a festival on for the people of Zaire, who have never seen anything like this in their life, I imagine. But there must have been, the way you sell it is because it's going to be on TV, and as the Rumble in the Jungle itself was going to be televised. So the idea was for you to make a film of this always?
Absolutely, 100%. The idea was a film. I mean, it was no coincidence that we shot 450,000 feet of film. You know, it was the largest documentary I think ever shot. And we were able to enlist the best shooters. That was the idea, was get these great cameramen from the Maisels to other guys who just get coverage, you know, and to shoot that stage like no one had done it, recorded the hell out of it. You know, that was my expertise. So everywhere we looked, we got the very best people that were available. Speaking of festivals, you only see him once, but there's a guy named Chip Monk, who was an old friend of mine, who was kind of the voice of Woodstock. He's on the bus at the beginning. He was really the guy who set the stage up and did all of that. And everywhere I looked, I was able to get only the best people because everyone was seduced by the idea.
But the idea, it strikes me, Stuart, that the idea of the concert film was still quite new. Yes, there'd been Woodstock, there'd been Monterey Pop, and there'd been, like, Don't Look Back. But very few concert films had kind of...
There wasn't any real reference to it, and that's what was intriguing. Therefore, when I went to try to enlist people to actually make the film, you know, I went to the big guy at the time named David Walper, who had, you know, was the king of documentaries. And this is a very unknown fact I'm giving you here. This is a good one. And Walper, I came out to California, met him, very slick, very, very, you know, the real thing. And he had a guy named Mel Stewart, who was the documentary maker. And it was good meeting and all, but square, you know, really square. You know, and I came from the other side of the street, you know. I had hung around R&B and jazz, and I was a Bronx, New York guy. I'm a street guy, you know, so these guys were like suits, man. I said, God damn, this ain't right. This isn't going to work. But we kind of had to get the best and do it. I didn't know anything about actually making a big documentary. And I got back to New York, and that night I went with some girl. It was a super hot day. I'll never forget it. We went into the theater, and there was a little movie called Our Latin Thing that was playing in New York, and she told me it was the greatest. I went in and saw it, and it knocked me out. It was all about the Latin music salsa scene, the early salsa scene in New York, and it was directed by this guy, Leon Gast. Mm. So it killed me, you know, small, funky. And I said it had just the right tone. So 2 hours later, I was with Leon Gast, having a drink in New York.
What I love about you in the film, because you look so idealistic and happy flying out there on this plane. I mean, it must have been the most extraordinary plane journey,
well,
with bongo players and brass instruments. It was fantastic.
No, you're right. It was fantastic. And the spirit was entirely about getting to do it. You know, there was nothing, it never entered my mind that we were going to make any money with it. Everybody got paid very well, very well. Nobody, you know, was sort of a favorite nations clause. You know, the only guy that got more than anybody was James Brown, but he was the most important artist in Africa at that time, Black American artist, by light years. Mm. You know, we had negotiated unsuccessfully with Stevie Wonder and Aretha and Sly, all of people. I mean, Sly was a friend, and Stevie was a friend, and that might have hurt the deal, actually. They wanted preferential treatment. They didn't want to come over on the same plane, and it was all this kind of prima donna shit, and there was no time for that. Having said that, James, was impossible, and he showed up at the airport with 50,000 pounds of extra equipment because he also got, we could go on for days, you and I.
Well, this was in cloaks. It was mainly in silver spangly cloaks.
He was amazing, actually. But he got a couple more shows in Africa after this, didn't tell anybody, and he brought his back line with him. You know, he brought all of his equipment.
Right about here, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to get yourself and your soul together. This man will make your liver quiver. This man will make your bladder splatter. This man will freeze your knees. If you will, let's all welcome the world's godfather of soul, soul brother number one, James Brown! James Brown! James Brown!
The one little detail you should know about the plane is that the fight had been posted. We left on a Tuesday, I remember clearly. And on a Monday, I found out about the fight being postponed. And I insisted and fought everybody in the fight side of it to not announce that until we had gotten on the plane. Because the deal with all the artists is that they got 50% of their money when they signed the contract. And the other 50% were in what you call letters of credit. And they were to get that money when they stepped foot in Africa. So if they didn't step foot in Africa, they would have gotten burnt, and I would have ended up being a cab driver in Zambia, you know? So I was faced with this horrible decision. Do we go on what was really essentially a fool's mission, or do we cancel it? So all alone in this, I decided we were going to go because I knew it would be a great, great thing for everybody since it wasn't about being part of the fight. We had our own thing, you know. So I announced to everybody on the plane that there was no fight. And their answer to that was that celebration. How about that one?
Well, man? You're very lucky because, I mean, you're 35,000 feet. It's a long way to be chucked out, long way down when you're chucked out of an aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think the thought hadn't entered my mind. I was beyond paranoid. I stood up in front of everybody and that's why I look a little bit like a tomato with blue eyes, you know. I had been up for a month, and I was wired and crazy. But I felt that this was going to be such a wonderful experience for everybody, having been to Africa a number of times. I knew how the country was waiting for them. The level of disappointment would have been intense. Everything was ready. The only thing that wasn't going to happen was that it wasn't going to be as planned with the fight. So my speech basically on the plane was, we're artists, we're musicians, this country's waiting for us, we're going to go over and have the best time, and it's going to be a gas. And I got a standing ovation, and that went into everybody starting to play. That was real, man.
Yeah, well, it just...
And it went on for hours. That was outside
amazing.
Of Madrid.
I mean, nowadays, that could never happen. Stewardesses,
nah.
You'd be like, go and sit down, your health and safety would
well,
never
we owned the plane. It was a charter, you know?
Right, so yeah, still. what I must say is that the film that we see now, it certainly, there's a lot of hope in that flight. And it seems to me it's the hope of a lot of American, African-American, we'll call them now, Black American men. It's about to set foot and realize they're setting foot in the kind of the motherland for the first time. It must have been at the time when, you know, Black consciousness was reaching its height, when Ali
Absolutely.
Was kind of being embraced by the Nation of Islam and going back to Africa. There was a very real sense of coming home for these guys.
100%, you know, 100%, you know, and you couldn't really make a parallel. It wouldn't be like Jews going to Israel, for instance. It was much stronger than that because culturally, and also, let's remember musically, you know, they all felt a debt to Africa, particularly the Latin guys, they knew there was a direct connection, and that was beautiful. Man.
Yeah,
was
but absolutely... I mean, there's some wonderful scenes, but yeah, I mean, obviously, the Spinners, they're from Detroit, and many people from Harlem, so they're used to seeing Black people, they get to Africa, and it could... Man, there's some Black people here.
There's Black people. And then when you see Ali say that, you know, I think it's in this film or the first one.
It is in this film, too.
Yeah, where he can't believe, you know, that. And also in the first film, he talks about there was a Black pilot. You know, that blew his mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And I had been there a number of times, so I knew they were going to get blown away, which is why in my decision, which I can't tell you how strange it was to make that decision, to go or not to go. I had no counsel. I had to decide on my own. I just knew that, you know, my partner, Masekela, was over there. Everyone was waiting. There were festivities on the ground. And I'm saying, what? And everyone's going to get paid. Why not go?
Yeah, for sure.
You know
sure.
what I mean? Just because it wasn't going to be what we intended. Listen, the whole thing was a goddamn scam anyway. You know what I mean? And I felt that the purpose of it was to create this consciousness of awareness of the connection between African and Americans, because I knew about it, having been involved in the music for, like, at that time, 13, 14 years. I was very sussed when it came to there really is a connection between these
for
two.
For sure, but I think it's much more, everyone acknowledges it now, but the roots began in Africa and the jazz connection and the Latin roots as well. But I think at the time it feels like it was dawning on all of you, or at least on all of them at the same time.
It was joyous, man. That isn't just filmmaking. When I saw it, it not made me look back. It made me feel like, you know, you were really in the middle of it.
Well, and it's the technical achievement here. The transfer is fantastic. It looks great. The sound is cleaned up to a fantastic degree.
Yeah, it sounds really good.
So for you as a music guy, it must be really important. It's crucial that the sound came well, because the performances that we can talk about, which are just, some of them are just terrific. Miriam McCabe's Click song is brilliantly done. Bill Withers' acoustic number is just...
That's unbelievable. That's my favorite moment. Right. You know, that's my favorite moment of all of it. And we recorded the shit out of it. We had the record plant, which was the Great Mobile. The owners came along. We had my engineer recorded all of it. The guy had done all my records. We had, you know, great analog. Let's remember, you know, the recordings were better then.
Stuart Levine there, a great record producer who found himself at the helm of producing one of the great music documentaries of all time, Soul Power. It had its premiere at Glastonbury recently. Its UK release nationwide is from this Friday, July the 10th. Talking of the hardest working man in show business, Zan Brooks joins me in the pod. Welcome back, Zan. This week we'll be looking at Bruno by Sacha Baron Cohen. We'll be looking at 35 Shots of Rum by Claire Denis. And we'll be looking at Paul Schrader's classic reissue, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. So let's start with Bruno, why not? This is Sacha Baron Cohen picking up where Borat left off. Let's have a little clip of Bruno. This is him trying to become famous, and he thinks, because he's a fashionista, that he should adopt a beautiful brown baby. Why not?
How did you find your son?
I swapped him.
You swapped him? Swapped
the baby for what?
For an iPod.
What?
Not just any iPod, once that was like limited edition, red. A U2 iPod, heard of it?
All right, but wait a second. You are the baby's father now, and you chose to dress that baby up in a T-shirt that says what?
Gaby.
That's not the baby's name, is it?
No. I gave him like a traditional African name.
So what's the baby's name?
OJ.
That's Bruno facing a real-life TV audience with his black baby, OJ. Zan Brooks, there's a lot of hype about Bruno. It's probably the comedy of the summer, or being billed that way. Is it fulfilling its hype?
I guess that remains to be seen. For me, it didn't quite. And I hate to say that, because I think that Sacha Baron Cohen is fiercely talented, and I'm predisposed to like whatever he does.
Really?
And I love Borat.
Yeah.
But this, I think, is a little more limited and a little more problematic.
So, well, I think you're right, but very strangely, I found this much funnier than I found Borat.
It's maybe more obviously funny.
Yeah.
Borat, I think, had more of an interesting social agenda.
Absolutely.
And I think that Borat was a thing of genius. It was a sort of open sesame that opened up a whole kind of world of ignorance and bigotry and prejudice and insularity within America. Here, I think that the character of Bruno is perhaps a little bit easier to dismiss. For all of the serious points that he's making, he's still the sort of flouncing, flamboyant, gay stereotype that we've seen a thousand times before.
It isn't, oh, let's go into Alabama and show America to be homophobic. That is not hardly a shock, because he's so camp and so gay that it's literally in your face half the time. So it's not like they're literally tired of this man, not because he's gay, but because he's wearing like hot pants in the middle of the night.
Sure, and part of the comedy is I wasn't sure whether we were kind of laughing with him or laughing at him.
But there are, I think, some genius moments in it of comedy, and beautifully played by Sacha Baron Cohen. I think this performance is an extraordinary performance.
It's an underrated thing about Sacha Baron Cohen is that he is a superb actor and a superb physical actor. When he's Borat, you can imagine him as this slightly ill-coordinated, hulking, six-foot-four lummox. Whereas as Bruno, you can almost imagine him as this very svelte, slender, 19-year-old pretty boy.
I did want to ask if you saw the version, because I didn't. I was in Edinburgh doing this show when the screening took place in London, the first screening, which it features a scene in which he interviews LaToya Jackson.
Yeah, I did see that.
So I haven't seen. They've cut that out now.
I wonder if that will come back at some point.
Of
times.
Surely on a DVD.
I'm sure. And it's a shame that that sequence has gone. And obviously that's them running scared. And there's this sort of an irony that you know, Bruno can blunder through the Middle East crisis. But a joke about Michael Jackson in the current climate is an absolute no-no. And so there is a scene that is now hidden in which he seizes LaToya Jackson's BlackBerry and goes through it and finds or seems to find Michael Jackson's home phone number and reads it out in German, and LaToya Jackson storms out of the interview.
See, I would quite like to see, because he gets Paula Abdul to storm out as well by sitting on Mexicans again, which I thought was inspired, genius, very funny, beautifully played.
Yeah.
So my Daumer are up for Bruno.
I think one of my Maundimers is up, very up. But, you know, it's a film of great moments,
yeah.
But also moments that I kind of resisted it.
There we go. Let's move on to Claire Denis and 35 Shots of Rum. This is the story of a family, sort of family, living in an apartment block in Paris. The dad's a train driver, the daughter's a student. Their relationships seem to be sort of disparate all over the place, and they come together gradually throughout the course of Claire Denis' film, 35 Shots of Rum.
14, 15, 16, 17, 19. À toi, Lionel. C'est parti. Des murs pour les 35 roms.
I mean, this is a film with fantastic music. Sophia George from her album Girly Girly, The Night Shift by the Commodores, brilliant music. Were you a fan of Claire Denis before this?
On and off. I really like Beau Travail.
Yeah.
I think she's very, very talented. A couple of her films have just completely passed me by. This one didn't. This one really connected. I thought this was kind of beautiful.
Yes,
really.
I did too.
It's subtle, it's elliptical. It's a, as you say, it's a family drama. It's a widower, a train driver in Paris who's living with his student daughter. And then it expands from that kind of very close domestic space to take in his work colleagues, the other people in the apartment block where they live. There's the neighbour who they have a very sort of odd, charged relationship with, where he was her one-time lover.
But we don't really know that.
And yeah, that's the implication. And a sort of surrogate mother to the daughter at one stage.
She seems still obsessed with him. And he seems very tired of her, but still they go out.
Yeah, a Hollywood drama would spell all this out. You would know in the first 10 minutes what these relationships are, and also be able to have a pretty educated guess as to how it's going to play out. Claire Denis doesn't do that. It's touching on things. There's little hints. It's a sort of drip, drip, drip of details. And I guess people are a mystery. Even people that you know are a mystery, and this film kind of captures
absolutely
that very well.
There's a wonderful shot quite early on of the building where they live, and it's kind of lit up like an advent calendar, a quiet Paris night with these windows.
A real window.
And it is, and it's all these little lives lived, and each one has its mystery, has its depths, has its kind of tragedies buried in it, and these people, we just happen to drop into their story.
Yeah, and it's the amazing window metaphor is great, because there are sort of moments of illumination where people are revealed, but a lot of it plays out behind the curtains, behind the walls. You're not quite sure what's going on.
Absolutely, and there's a relationship with a boy upstairs called Noé, who I didn't like, actually. I was like,
I don't think you're meant to quite like him.
No, she's gorgeous, the woman, the daughter. And I was thinking, oh God, I hope she doesn't...
Matty Diop.
Yes, I hope she doesn't sort of fall in love with him because he's a bad un.
Yeah,
but maybe
feel,
that's what we do.
You feel that you're kind of being sucked into these lives. And, you know, this is, in its very quiet way, this is a film about relationships, about work, about what gets left behind, and about what we're doing here.
Yeah, but
all those little trifling
all those
things.
I mean, the first scene, which I thought that the father and daughter were lovers, actually, because they were so tender with each other. And that's just me reading it. I'm sure there's nothing in the film to suggest this at all, but it's just me in the domestic routine. She brings him his slippers, she cooks the dinner.
Well, it's a film that encourages you to make those jumps and those connections.
And the big shot was
sometimes
when she says,
pass
the sauce, and she says, oh, thanks, Daddy. And I was like, oh, right, he's your dad.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But isn't that like when you meet people?
Yeah.
When you meet a couple, when you go into a room where there's five or six people you haven't met before, you are automatically making assumptions about them that are then more often than not undermined. And this is a film that does that, and it gently pulls the rug out from under you.
Absolutely. It's lived on with me, absolutely. It's nuances, it's subtleties of everyday life, and the music, I love it. This is a film where music just doesn't appear on the soundtrack. They press the button, they press play, or they turn on
it's
the radio.
It's so much more honest.
It's like real
that
music,
yeah.
and a wonderful use of of the Commodore's Night Shift for a very tender scene with a sexual kind of energy in the bar is passed around. I mean, the more I think about this film, I think it's absolutely brilliant. It might be one of my favourite films of the year.
I think
so
it could be mine. And we're getting a strange process here in this podcast, aren't we? Where the more we talk about these films, the more we like them.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on from Claire Denis, 35 Shots of Rum. Really, I think when we do the top tens at the end of the year, this might well still
I think
be
it might
featuring.
Join mine as well.
Yeah, well, good. Well, we can't argue about that then if that doesn't happen.
Let's argue about Mishima.
Okay, let's argue about Mishima, which I actually had to go and see sort of straight after 35 Shots of Rum, and it took me a long while to settle into it. I was still thinking about 35 Shots of Rum when Mishima had started, and I thought, well, it'll be fine.
It's the tyranny of the movie screenings, isn't it, where you go from one to the next, and actually, particularly with a Claire Denis film, you need to give it a day or two
to really settle, like the hangover from 35 Shots of Rum would give you. But I went straight into Mishima, and God, that was it's kind of a hard work. This is Paul Schrader's 1985 film, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. Reissued on at the ICA. It's a film I hadn't seen before.
Really? Wow.
So I didn't really know anything about Mishima. I hadn't read any Mishima. So I was intrigued about this film, which it takes the form of flashback back to his childhood. And the clip we've got here is him flashing back to when he's at school and falls in love with the portrait, the image of San Sebastian, and his whole kind of obsession with male body and bodybuilding goes on from there.
Suddenly I came across a picture whose only purpose had been to lie in wait for centuries and ambush me. The white, matchless beauty of the youth's body hung against a tree trunk, his hands tied by thongs. I trembled with joy. My loins swelled. My hand unconsciously began a motion it had never been taught. My need to transform reality was an urgent necessity, as important as three meals a day or sleep.
Paul Schrader's Mishima, Zan, is it a classic for you?
It'd be great if Bruno remade Mishima, wouldn't it, having listened to that clip? That would be very interesting to see.
Mishy-moshy.
But yes, to answer your question, I really like this film.
Yeah.
I think this is one of Schrader's greatest films, I think. And I think it's a film that's sort of underrated. It's not really seen as a classic in the way that it should be. It's a very difficult film. It's very unforthcoming. It's cold as a penny.
That's why I say I found it so difficult to get into after 35 Shots of Rum, which was so empathetic and warm and directed by a kind of very warm female director. Yeah. Schrader is such a cold,
yeah,
manly,
Schrader doesn't want to
man.
Let you in. Yeah, and also this is such wish fulfillment, isn't it? You know that Schrader is seeing himself as the American version of Yukio Mishima, and he has all those same obsessions that sort of a luxuriating in the myth of what it is to be a man, and that sort of that quest for purity that's actually completely contaminated.
Well, he's in a line of Schrader heroes, I suppose. Absolutely. That run from Travis Bickle to I can't remember the name of American Gigolo.
Richard Gere character in American Gigolo, right up to the Woody Harrelson character in Schrader's most recent film, The Walker. Who are these sort of flawed, pure anti-heroes who kind of live outside society's norms and are then betrayed by the society that they can never quite fit in with. Mishima was all about making his own myth, so you have a sense that he was confused about what was real and what was fake. And that all folds into this incredibly ordered, formal narrative that Schrader constructs.
Hey, I do feel that whilst I wanted to find out more about Mishima, and I do still need to find out more about Mishima after watching this film, I don't really know anything about him other than, you know, he kind of took an army colonel capture and committed seppuku or harikiri.
That's all he wants you to know about him, though, isn't it? Whole thing is constructing himself. He's a construct. And Schrader is fascinated by these people who are constructs and we never get to know. So in that way, it is kind of similar to 35 Shots of Rum. And yet, obviously, 35 Shots of Rum leads you in and makes you get to know them, whereas Schrader holds you at arm's length.
Absolutely. And again, musically, sort of an inspired film. Philip Glass's soundtrack is almost better known than the Mishima film itself.
Yeah, it is. And possibly even deserves to be. In that I normally steer clear of film soundtracks, and yet many years ago I went and bought this film soundtrack, and I think it's probably only about one of five film soundtracks I've ever actually bought in my life.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It's so fitting for the film.
There's a lot of twiddling and a lot of it's quite insistent, a little bit annoying, and that's kind of how I find the film
The remorseless military drums in there.
Absolutely.
and the strings, and it's a frosting on a very cold film.
That's Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters by Paul Schrader, which is on at the ICA in a reissue and I think going around the country as well. So catch it if you dare. Zan Brooks, lovely to have you back as ever. I will be away next week, so it's over to you.
I'm in the hot seat next week, so let's hope I don't screw it up.
You'll be fine. If you want to read more of Zan's work, go, of course, to guardian.co.uk/film. Now, if you've listened to our Edinburgh Film Festival edition already, you'll know that we promised to play out the second half of our interview with actress Robin Wright Penn and writer-director Rebecca Miller, whose The Private Lives of Pippa Lee goes on release this week. Robin Wright Penn stars as Pippa Lee, who's married to Alan Arkin's publisher, and she reassesses her life when she finds out he's having an affair, and she flashes back and forth over the stages of her life that have made her the Pippa Lee that she is now.
The past few years, I can feel you're starting to bury me, Pippa. I can feel the earth in my mouth, almost as if you're looking forward to it.
How can you say that?
I can feel you starting to pity me, being afraid of me. You're already in the mourning. Don't deny it.
I mean, of course, I am afraid of you getting old and dying. It's normal to be afraid.
Well, I don't want to be normal, and I don't want to be mourned. I'm not a ghost. I want to live. Nobody knows when the hell they're going to die. You could die tomorrow.
So at the end of part one of the interview, I spoke to Robin Wright Penn about working with the great Alan Arkin, who plays opposite her as the aging husband. And I asked Rebecca Miller why and how she'd chosen Arkin for that part.
I sent in the part and, thinking, gosh, he would be perfect and he can play both. But, you know, it was hard to find someone who could play 80 and somebody in his late 50s, you know. And I thought, you know, he could do it and... But he said to his agents, okay, I'll talk to her. So I call him up. The first thing he says, I don't want to have this experience. I said, okay. And he said, I don't want to play this guy. I said, okay. And he said, I know this guy very well. I know guys like this. I don't want to play this guy. I said, okay. So how are you? Where are you? I just made conversation. We hung up. I called my casting director, Cindy, and said, well, so he's passed. She said, are you sure? He said, yeah. She said, let me just call the agent before we go to anyone else. They call up, and there's a day's silence. He wants to talk to you. Apparently, his agent, his manager, and his lawyer called him and yelled at him. All three of them yelled at him. He said, what are you doing? Finally, you've been complaining that there are no good parts. Here's this part. It's a great part. I get on the phone with him. He said, what if on page 10, he says, instead of saying this, he says this. And it would be like word change, word order changes, little lines, this and this. He kisses on their head. On third page 35, I think he should kiss her on the head because it'll make him a nicer guy. Okay, do that. More affection here and there. And then at the end of it, you know, we've agreed. We've on the phone for 2 hours. At the end of this, I say, so you want to do it? He said, yeah, I guess so.
Well, what part of the experience did he not want to do? He didn't want to have an affair with Winona Ryder. He didn't want to be married to Robin Wright Penn. He didn't want to be to stare his own mortality in the face.
You know, I'm afraid I don't actually know, but it hit a nerve. He didn't want to. He knew that part, and it was very interesting to me. He said, "I don't want to have this experience," is what he said. He didn't say, "I don't want to play the part." Mm. And it's a sign of a great actor, because what he was saying is, I'm going to be this guy, yeah. And I don't want to be this guy that betrays this way. I don't want to do these things. Mm-hmm. And in some way, it hit close to home in whatever way. It was it was just, in a funny way, it was like too good of a part.
Yeah.
And he rejected it, but he couldn't, you know, finally he did it. And he did it. I mean, he was so good, wasn't he? It was like watching a cat. Like, you didn't have any questions. Oh, is the cat doing a good job being a cat? He was a cat.
Mm. What was he like to actually play off of, Robin?
Oh, he's genius, because he's also the mastery of improv.
Right.
I mean, I remember doing a lot of that he would instigate.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally within character and absolutely didn't depart from the scene and the relationship.
Yeah.
That was so believable, I felt, that, you know, we were married and we had this history together. And yes, we were, you know, 10, 20 years difference in age. And
It's testament to the relationship that you managed. When you do fill the relationship in with Blake Lively, and it's beautifully done and how they met. In a way, I'd kind of had the... It was different. I'd actually thought how they'd met before. I didn't know that the movie was going to take me back over Pippa's life and how they met. But I kind of, you'd done all that work already, just in the looks and the relationship that you had with Alan, right?
We did, and we also, I didn't feel the need to analyze so much with Alan. I had already done that with Rebecca, who had written that dynamic, that chemical reaction that happens with actors, and I'm sure directors feel it too when people walk into a room or let me get this actor with this actor, and it's magical when it connects, you know? Yeah. And it's tragic when there's a synapse, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Just like,
yeah.
And the dynamic totally, it was there. I didn't feel like we had to talk it to death, therapize it to death.
Yeah.
We got to do that, Rebecca and I.
Yeah. And you're still doing it now, which is great.
Yeah, it's so great. It's forever evolving.
Tell me about the location as well, because it's a strange world. One that it's kind of, a retirement home for burnt out New York intellectuals?
Yes, essentially. I mean, it is a place. It's a retirement home in Connecticut, which at least in the past was known for having quite a lot of intellectuals living there. You know, and that whole area is where I grew up. So that, you know, the convenience store and all that sense, New Milford and all that, those my old stomping ground. Not necessarily the convenience store itself, but
It was your territory.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. Mm. Yeah.
So this reminded, you know, your films are so personal, Rebecca, and I never like to, you know, verge into the personal world, but you put them out there for us to kind of empathize with. So, and you have to think, well, was Alan that, did he remind you of the relationship that you were having with your father, not as a obviously married, but living with and going through his illnesses?
Well, you know, I have an ear for the cadence of New York intellectuals, Jews, you know, a very strong ear for that, because my father was one, but he was so distant from what Herb is, being an artist and being, you know, not between being a writer and being a publisher, it was a great big distance.
Sure.
You know, Zoe's relationship with her dad reminds me a tiny bit of my relationship with my dad, I have to say. That kind of complicity and that sort of sense that he's proud of you and, you know, that clubbiness and, you know, for sure.
My thanks to Rebecca, daughter of Arthur Miller there, and Robin Wright Penn too. That's all we've got for you this week. It almost goes without saying that the music featured in this week's podcast is from the documentary Soul Power. It's a must hear as well as a must see. Do join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans is our group. Also follow us on Twitter, Film Weekly, it's our handle on there. And if you mostly listen to us on the Guardian site, why not just subscribe via iTunes? Just under our player is the subscribe button. Press it and pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday for my trailer trash column and the best film news and reviews in the world. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Fitz, it's goodbye.